Happy Friday, everyone. We're here with me, Kathleen Wynn, on Wynn Tucson, and we have a lot of things to talk about today. There's not a shortage of issues or problems, and hopefully we'll give you some great information that you can be the smartest one amongst your friends this weekend, and you can say, I heard that on Wynn Tucson. I am excited about our first guest today. Jonathan Williams is a chief economist and executive vice president of policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, also known as ALEC. ALEC works with state policymakers, our state legislators, congressional leaders, and members of the private sector to develop fiscal policy solutions for states. Williams founded ALEC's Center for State Fiscal Reform in 2011, and if we needed fiscal reform ever, now would be the time. Jonathan, thank you for joining me this morning on Wynn Tucson.
Well, it's great to be with you, and you're no kidding, right? We need some real fiscal responsibility ASAP here in Washington. I always call Washington the land of make-believe, and certainly living up to that name, unfortunately, every single day more and more.
Yes, it is a fantasy island, if only we could get a plane to get off of it. I'm very familiar with the work of ALEC, and especially as it relates to our state legislature. You do a great job of working with our state. I know that firsthand, but would you mind telling the listeners and the people in Arizona about ALEC and your policies that you've done, but everything that ALEC is doing behind the scenes? I think it would be really a useful way to start the conversation.
Well, sure, happy to. ALEC has been around for nearly 50 years now as an organization to be a trusted policy resource for America's state legislators. And we don't do it in a partisan context. We do it in a context of good public policy and items that work, and taking the idea of federalism, the 50 laboratories of democracy, that we ought to be able to take the best of ideas and replicate those and avoid the worst of ideas to make sure we aren't doubling down on mistakes. ALEC produces things like model policy, where legislators can take that if they so choose, if it's within the things they'd like to pursue, and they're hearing from constituents, and introduce those. And they've been vetted as best practices in terms of what has worked in this context of 50 states in dynamic competition with each other. You know, just a couple of those areas have been things that Arizona has done even recently that we're very proud of Arizona. And, the book that I co-author, one of the things we do is put together quite a few studies and books, and Rich States, Poor States is one of those that I author with Art Laffer, who is Reagan's economic advisor, and Steve Moore, who was Donald Trump's economic advisor. And we rank the states based on free market economic competition. And, a couple of things that Arizona's done that we're so excited about, and this is just a great example of how ALEC model policy has been, introduced and then passed in places like Arizona, are things like school choice. With their just incredible ESA reform, where dollars will now follow parents and kids instead of bureaucracies in Arizona. And then also the flat tax, and seeing the just amazing tax reductions and budget reductions that you've been able to see, and the kind of economic growth that I think that's going to bring once again to Arizona. So that's just a snapshot. We're a nonpartisan individual membership organization. So we ask Democrats, Republicans, independents, libertarians, vegetarians, legislators of any kind across the board to get involved with us to have access to these kind of resources that we provide.
That's great. So I want to go back because you mentioned this. So in July, Governor Ducey signed into law the Empowerment Scholarship Account Bill, which was ESAs, as we've come to know it. And it was the most expansive education freedom legislation in the country. So we don't do a lot of good things here for education in Arizona. We kind of get beat up for where our students are at and how things are going. However, this was based on an ALEC model policy. And can you just tell me maybe just a little bit, so you've acknowledged us for it, but how did you develop this policy? And we know that my understanding is that the money follows the student. So whether they stay in a public school, they go to a charter school, they go to a private school, this policy made it so that the dollars that are delineated for our students stay with the student. And how did you come to that decision, or why did you determine that this was a good policy, not only for Arizona, but maybe across the country?
Yeah, I think we're big fans, and we hope that every state looks at what Arizona did, and hopefully they can do something like it that makes sense for their state. But you know, rewind the clock a little bit, going back even to the 1990s, you know, Alec has been a real leader on educating around real school choice, whether it was charter schools or whether it was pro-homeschool legislation, or whether it was things like this that then dynamically developed by legislators bringing it to us and coming up with concepts for, you know, what actually can work to create a market within education. Because you alluded to the fact that Arizona has been, you know, lagging in a lot of the indicators for years past, and we see this across the country in so many cases. But one of the big reasons there is there's no competition. You don't have a market, and parents don't have a lot of choices in many cases, and they're stuck in failing school districts in many cases. And we don't customize the education to the needs of the child. We have this one-size-fits-all approach in many cases. And that's why this approach with your ESA is so, I think, impactful, and will be a game changer for the educational outcomes of families and kids all across Arizona. But more recently, we've seen many states adopt different school choice efforts. So whether it was Jeb Bush in Florida, who was became famous for that 20 years ago, Wisconsin in Milwaukee and in inner city. But last year we had West Virginia, where one of our ALEC legislators, Senator Patricia Rucker, immigrant from Venezuela, who introduced, they call it the Hope Scholarship Program in West Virginia, that is very similar to what Arizona has done. Arizona, I think, was even more generous and expansive with the program than West Virginia is for many reasons. But that's the most recent iteration that I think the ALEC model is based on, a lot of the concepts from West Virginia and just many of the other things that legislators learn from their states and bring to ALEC.
I think that's great. And what we're going to see, hopefully, in this next cycle, this school year that we're now in, is that we start to see improved scores, that we start to see people exercising this great policy that's been put into place. And I think during COVID, parents kind of woke up and saw what was happening in their schools. I know we had a big pushback on content and some other things. So if parents have a choice, they now have an ability to educate their child in the way that they choose to and that they want to. And I think that a lot of parents got woke up over the last couple of years, so the timing of this was actually impeccable, too. So, go ahead.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that, and we're seeing this as a major push across the country. As legislators hear from their constituents and those parents, we're looking over their kids' shoulders on the laptops during the lockdown years, and in many cases asking themselves in a bewildered sense, you know, what in the world are they learning? What are they being taught in our public schools in many cases? And what kind of values, if any, are being taught? And I think that's something that came certainly to the forefront in Virginia, that anybody follows politics here. We had former Governor Terry McAuliffe, who wanted to be governor again, ran against Glenn Youngkin this last year, and said out loud what I think he probably thought for many years, which was, he said, incredibly, that parents shouldn't have a say, basically, in their kids' education. And right. That just set off something where Virginia had been going very liberal in many cases for several election cycles, but then elected a conservative governor because parents said enough is enough.
Jonathan, we'll be right back. We have to take a break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about not reality in Washington and what happened this last week on the White House lawn. I'm here with my special guest, Jonathan Williams, and we'll be right back after this break. Solutions for everyday problems. Welcome back to Win Tucson. I'm Kathleen Wynn with my very special guest, Jonathan Williams, ALEC, Chief Economist and Executive Vice President of Policy. Jonathan, this week we saw a very strange celebration on the White House lawn. President Biden, Nancy Pelosi were celebrating what they are considering their economic successes. And on the very day that they were celebrating, our stock market was plummeting and inflation rose again 8.3% higher than we were just a year ago. So I'm a big fan of James Taylor, but was there a disconnect there?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I'm a big fan of James Taylor as well. He got put into an impossible situation there by the President of the United States. And I think someday some political science professor is going to coin this event as the definition of just politically tone deaf. looking at what just happened with inflation, those massive numbers, over 8%, core inflation rising even faster than the month before, being well above where economists suggested it would be with some of the dropping gasoline prices. And then, as you point out, the absolutely devastating images that you see on the screen as CNN and Fox and other networks were covering the event, as the Dow and the S&P and the major markets were tumbling for their worst day since 2020, back in the midst of the COVID lockdowns. This is just a complete, just a definition of economic malpractice, and the malpractice on behalf of the White House staff that they went forward with this event to party and have a musical celebration while Americans are suffering. Because when you look at what this inflation has done, I mean, it's easy for us economists to talk about, well, 8.3 versus 8.1, expectations versus core inflation. But what does that mean for the average American out there, the hardworking taxpayer? In that, my friend Steve Moore just put out the statistics that the average American worker has lost more than $3,400 in annual wages during Joe Biden's administration. I mean, this is the stuff that is going to dog the Biden White House and progressives across the board. And they just keep doubling down on spending more, taxing more, and then I think, ironically, just redefining or trying to their way out of the problem.
I think the spending is the other thing. As families are struggling to try to make ends meet, do you put gas in your car? Do you put food on your table? Just worrying about everyday life. And then the government is spending our tax money everywhere. Ukraine, just every program that you can imagine, they just seem to be almost like a drunken sailor, just throwing their money everywhere. And I think that the everyday person, the average American who is not engaged in worrying about inflation or the economy, but just being impacted, hopefully they go to the polls and they vote and they don't endorse what's happening. Why do you think inflation continues to be so persistent? It certainly isn't transitory, as President Joe Biden has claimed that it is.
Well, there's no doubt that the current just explosion in spending in Washington is spending money like drunken sailors. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, this is just something that, you know, I think it's continuing on because guess what? They just put more fuel on the fire with the so-called misnamed Inflation Reduction Act, where it actually spent hundreds of billions of dollars more, taxed more, and by the way, unleashed the IRS with 87,000 new agents and $80 billion to go and potentially harass law-abiding American citizens to bring in another $200 billion of federal revenue so then they can go on another spending spree. So I think, you know, Americans see this. They see the disconnect between how they conduct a kitchen table budget for their families, how they give up a vacation, how they give up some special things in order to make things balance at the end of the day. They look at how even the states, I mean, 49 of the 50 states have balanced budget requirements, like Arizona.
Correct.
They say you've got to live within your means. You can't print money. And they see the disconnect of what's happening in Washington. And I think that's why you see the approval ratings where they're at with Congress and President Biden.
Well, I think I heard Ms. Yellen say that the, how do I want to put this? I'll come back to that. I apologize. I believe that she was saying that this was not a, I'll come back. She said something yesterday that was so ridiculous. Oh, these weren't agents. These were just customer service representatives for the IRS. It was so absurd, I couldn't remember it. But they were hiring all these people to help people understand their taxes because taxes are so complex. And so these really weren't agents. These were just customer service reps that they are hiring. That's what it
well,
was.
Well, as we say down south.
I probably wanted to forget it was so bad.
That is just an unbelievable line that she would say that with a straight face. And there's been so many of them from Secretary Yellen that anyone can be forgiven for, confusing all the different things that she said in the strange lines. But on this one in particular, you have to ask yourself the question of why are they guaranteeing the fact that as part of their projections of this Inflation Reduction Act, they would get another $200 billion in excess IRS federal revenue through the IRS action. Folks, that's not people picking up the phone call to help you out with the question on your tax return. That is them coming over and forcing you to turn over documents and paying penalties and interest if they find a violation after they audit you.
It's crazy. So earlier you mentioned the flat tax. So many states, as you've said, including Arizona, are moving in the opposite direction as the federal government when it comes to tax and fiscal policies. And thank God we're not following the policies of the current federal government. Arizona adopted a flat tax this year, part of what Alec is calling the flat tax revolution. Will you just expand on that for our listeners? Because I think this is a really important thing. We're hearing about taxes. We're hearing about increase in taxes potentially. And we have some ballot measures here that could possibly increase taxes. So I'm not a big fan of taxes. I don't think anybody is. But why is it good that we are part of a revolution for a tax?
Well, this has been a historic year. And for those of us that track this closely, in the history of the United States, states have already been taxing income for the last 120 years or so. And this was a record year in 2022 we had five states go from being progressive, anti-growth, anti-taxpayer systems to flat tax systems, with Arizona, of course, being one of the five. And any other previous year, we had only had one state, let's say, that became a flat tax. And so we not only broke the records, but we just blew them out of the way, because they get the natural response to just this economic malpractice coming from Washington, D.C. with higher taxes and inflation. Legislators knew that they can't control the Federal Reserve, they can't control Congress, they can't control President Biden, but within their sphere of control and influence, they can absolutely make people's lives better off by reducing taxes on hardworking taxpayers. And that has been, the greatest story never told by the mainstream media this year, as they would like to focus on the doom and gloom and the political back and forth. But this is substantive reform that will last decades in places like Arizona and really put Arizona on a trajectory for even more economic growth going forward.
Well, and I have to look at the Biden administration. It's kind of like Rome's Emperor Nero, right? Fiddling while Rome was burning. The Dow Industrial Average was down 1,276 points, or almost 4% at the market close. The S&P fell 4.32%, and NASDAQ sank 5.2%. It was the worst day for 2022, and they didn't have the intelligence or the sensitivity to cancel an event. It was like they planned a party. And I think you mentioned it earlier, can Biden continue to be tone deaf to the needs of the American people and not get just annihilated in midterms? They may have more money for commercials. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think he was extremely damaging to him this last week putting that event together, and his people should have known better to cancel the event. Maybe we should thank them for at least being honest to their views that people should be celebrating. But I think the huge disconnect between what they're saying and what's actually happening, what people are feeling in their own bank accounts, their own pocketbooks, their own budget discussions around the kitchen table, you can only gaslight people for so long before they pick up to the truth. And I think Americans are there. They realize that this inflation problem is not going away. If anything, we've added fuel to the fire with this administration's policies. And so I think the Biden administration and the left here in Washington is in for a drubbing when it comes to November.
What do you think of, what do you say is the solution? What do you, if you're advising legislators right now around the country, how do you get them from where we are so that we can turn this ship around, if you will? And let's just hope Titanic's not printed on the side.
Yeah, right. Well, I think, the first thing is, when you're in a hole, the first step is to stop digging it deeper. And that is absolutely what we need to do, is how do we turn around the trajectory of now $30 trillion of national debt, quickly approaching $31 trillion? How do we pare that back? That's obviously going to take different voices here in Washington, D.C., likely to make that happen. But I think, more importantly, what state lawmakers can do is continuing to double down on the fiscal responsibility and living within their means and cutting taxes and giving their hardworking taxpayers a break in order to show this contrast of policy visions. And then, the idea, at least when it comes to federalism, is those good ideas would bubble up to Washington, and we can learn something for the states and learn something from the spending limits that places like Colorado and Michigan and others have in their constitution to say government can't grow faster than the private sector economy, and look at things like that. But it's going to be a long road ahead. We didn't accumulate $30 trillion of debt overnight. We're not going to eliminate it overnight, but we absolutely have to start moving in the right direction.
So, Jonathan, I want to just thank you for coming on today, for making yourself available, for letting us know that in Arizona we actually are doing something right when it comes to our business and our taxes and our policies, and continue to work with our legislators. Have a great weekend, and I hope to have you back on our show very soon. Jonathan Williams,
thanks so much for having me.
Chief Economist of ALEC. Thank you so much. Welcome back. It's Kathleen Wynn with Wynn Tucson. It's time to solve problems by speaking up and bringing solutions to everyday issues. On the second half of my show, I am excited to talk to Jason Fike. He is founder of the Social Media Freedom Foundation. And Jason is working on an issue that is near and dear to my heart, Communication Decency Act, Section 230. It involves, you've heard about it, if you've heard about freedom of speech, of Facebook, of censorship, but there's so many things that this law, this act in statute has affected. And I am not the expert. That's why I brought Jason on to talk to us about it. And how do we fix all the things that are broken right now with our communication and censorship and what is happening in our country? So, Jason, thank you for agreeing to be on the show today. Very excited to talk to you. Welcome to Wynn Tucson.
Sure thing, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
So you have been working on some draft legislation. I don't know if it's fair to say it's done, but the Online Freedom Act, is that, can you tell my listeners what that is and why this has become, I won't say an obsession, but a passion of yours?
I'd honestly call it an obsession. It's one of those, I have one focused goal, and it's to stop this mess. So the Online Freedom Act is actually the culmination of a few things. Obviously, we have a problem with this statute, Section 230, and for your viewers, your listeners that don't know what it is, it's the law that's protecting these big tech companies, simply put.
Correct.
Right? This law's been around for a while, and it protects these companies when they act as publishers, okay? But that's in certain aspects. But the thing is that the way that the law is written, it's so vague and so convoluted that it's been exploited, right? So all these companies are now exploiting this law to use it however they choose because they know that they've got the protection of government, right?
Right.
Now, the thing is, the government itself can't control it. Courts, are basically at the mercy of saying, well, they can do whatever they want. That's actually not how it works, believe it or not. Now, what...
We don't have a lot of evidence for that. That's not how it works, but I trust you that is true.
Well, the reason I'm saying that's not how it works is because I do have a lot of evidence that says otherwise, and that's actually what I'm going to talk to you about. So I've spent easily 10,000 plus hours on the Section 230 problem. I have litigation against Facebook, and I have a constitutional challenge on the books right now. Matter of fact, I'm literally going back and forth with the Attorney General because they're trying to dismiss us rather than fight the merits of the case. The thing about it is that because it is so vague and exploitable, the courts can't control it, and it becomes essentially almost sovereignty. They can do whatever they want. Mm. Well, that's not how it was intended, and that we can confirm because Congress never intended to give them the ability to do anything they want that's unlawful, right? I mean, that's absurd.
Yeah. So no law should allow others to break the law.
Bingo. And that's really what Section 230 does. It doesn't just allow them to remove content and not be treated as someone else. It allows them to commit unlawful acts against others under the insulation of government protection. And the thing is, we've gone all the way back to the law's structure and its constitutionality, right? So this gets into some more of the technical stuff. But to put it simply, the title, which nobody refers to, you never hear it anywhere, but it says Protection for Good Samaritan Blocking and Screening of Offensive Materials. And that puts it very simply for everyone, right? it's called the long title. What do they get? They get protection, right? So they're getting protection. And what do they have to do? Well, they have to block and screen offensive materials, which is what the government asked them to do, right?
Right.
And if they do that, how do they have to do it? Well, that's what Good Samaritan is, meaning they have to do it for the good of others in the interest of the public, right? And Good Samaritans, I mean, if you think about the core of it, what is it? That you either can render aid, right, which is to remove the content, or if you fail to render aid, you're also not held accountable for what you didn't do. That's how 230 works.
Hasn't some of the mischief been, though, in the determining what's offensive? Because I think that's where, at least from political speech or during COVID, many of these platforms would remove content. Twitter is notorious for this because they deemed it was offensive. And then you have the quagmire of freedom of speech. So can you explain that maybe at a different level for the listeners?
Sure. So what I was talking about, exploitation, that's exactly what you're referring to here. This is the exploitation. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to clarify, because everybody says, well, it's their First Amendment rights. It is. Twitter, let's just take Twitter, for example, and we'll just use it as a good example. Twitter has a right to take down any content it wants, and it has a right to put up any content it wants, right? However, if it takes down content in a normal setting, and that means absent Section 230, if it acted upon some content, it would become the publisher of all of the content on its site, and in doing so, it would be held liable for things it didn't even know were there. That's how 230 originated.
So when they transition from a platform to a publisher, they then have other obligations as a publisher. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, it's not necessarily obligations, but they can be held accountable for what they have not removed.
Got it.
Because they're acting as an editing system. That's what happened in Stratton Oakmont. It was like the first case that this was predicated upon. And what happened there is that they held themselves out to be family friendly. They removed some content that wasn't family friendly, and then they were held accountable for what they missed. And like a Good Samaritan, you can miss acts, right? It's the omission of action, the failure to act. Well, they got held accountable, and the government said, well, wait a second. We kind of want to let these technology companies be able to take down bad content, and we don't want them to be, considered the publisher, of all the rest of it. And that's why they wrote 230C1. That's the next piece, right?
Yes.
So that's piece number one. But the thing is that it says specifically that the provider or user shall not be treated as the publisher. Well, the publisher denotes the leading publisher or the principal publisher, the first guy, right?
Correct.
Whoever put it up there. Well, everybody knows that that's common sense, right? So it's someone else. Do you realize that what most people don't know, and this is the big reveal, it's like a magic trick, big reveal here, right?
Okay.
Out of 500 cases that have been dismissed on Section 230 grounds, do you know that only 19 were dismissed on 230C2, meaning 481 of them were dismissed under 230C1? Now, you might think to yourself, well, wait, it's probably because they were being held accountable for what lots of other people did. No. In fact, 230C1, and I know this for a fact because it happened to me, they dismissed my case where Facebook removed my content, right?
Right.
And dismissed them because they said I was treating them as a publisher. And that sounds correct, but that's not what the statute says. It says that they shall not be treated as the publisher. And my content was published by me.
Correct.
So who's the publisher? Me. I was never treating Facebook as me. What's happened here is that one little preposition, the publisher, the, has been converted and used synonymously with the word a. Well, it changes everything, right?
Yes.
And that happened all the way back at the beginning, literally the first case. They've confused it, and 230C1 meant that they just couldn't be treated as a publisher in general. Well, that's a problem, right? Because then they can do anything they want. And there's no good faith in 230C1. But we know it's wrong. You know why we know it's wrong? Because it would swallow the next section, which is C2, which is the part where they're supposed to do the moderation. It has no function anymore. It's literally just redundant. Now, the courts have tried to resolve that, and the resolution doesn't really help because they say, well, no. 230C2 has a different function, and literally it says perhaps because they developed information even in part. Well, great. They just confused it even more because 230C2 allows them to restrict content. It doesn't allow them to put content up, and it doesn't allow them to develop it, right? Because that's what development is. It's essentially manipulating or advancing or messing with content at all. But that is actually the exact definition of a content provider. Huh. Well, wait a second. So C2 allows them to be a content provider, which means that if they're developing information, C1 couldn't apply because the information wasn't provided by another, which is what it says.
When we come back, we're going to have to take a break. And when we come back, okay. I want to go back over the C1 and the C2 and what that means to the average person who's using these platforms. Sure. I am grateful to have Jason Pike with me this morning. And we will be back right after this break. Kathleen Nguyen, Nguyen Tucson. Welcome back to Nguyen Tucson. I'm your host, Kathleen Nguyen. And my special guest today is Jason Pike, founder of the Social Media Freedom Foundation. And Jason, is it fair to say you're a recovering attorney?
No, recovering? No, I'm not an attorney at all.
Okay.
Former attorney. I'm one.
Well, your education has served you well because this is complex, but this is such a critical problem that needs solving. And as we look at C2, if I'm correct, this is this is where there's protections against obscenity, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, otherwise unlawful materials. Is that what that covers? Or
correct. Okay. C2 basically is the coverage for the site's actions, and C1 is when they don't act. That is the correct, simple interpretation of it, but it's not how it applied in the courts. And that's where most people don't realize where this problem lies. So, and that's exactly what the OFA is trying to do, the Online Freedom Act, right?
Correct.
What happens is that because the language of the law itself is vague and confusing, the courts have just completely misapplied it. It's just wrong. And we're talking a mountain of cases. Lots of them are wrong. So we have to plow backwards against tons of bad precedent. The precedent that, you know, all the experts use to understand it, it's wrong. And see, what the OFA does is we go in and we don't have to actually, and I tell people, we're not reinventing the wheel with this law. It could work. It's a matter of there's just not enough spokes. There's not enough pieces to understand how it works. So if we install spokes, it'll start to spin properly, right, and work. So in the Online Freedom Act, and I get asked all the time, well, what does it do? Well, first thing it does is it clarifies that this first section is when the site has nothing to do with moderation, that it simply is hosting. That's what most people understand as a platform. But what most people miss is it also is passive publishing. So they're technically a publisher and a platform simultaneously. There's no distinction. Okay. And the second piece, C2, is when they actually get involved as a publisher and actively moderate. That's the simplicity of it. The Online Freedom Act, it clarifies C1 so it doesn't, interfere with C2, so C2 would have a purpose again and be applied correctly, and good faith would once again start to work. Good Samaritan is finally recognized, which is to say that, you know, protecting a company from wiping out the competition for their own financial gain is not a good Samaritan. You shouldn't get any protection, period, which is what my personal case against Facebook is about. But here, and the thing that it also goes on to do is that not only do we clarify what was supposed to happen in 230 and clean all that up, we have a section that has completely been overlooked because Section 230 is a delegation of authority. It is. It's simple as that. They say that they're not state actors, but we said they're supposed to block and screen offensive materials. They can have a voluntary choice whether to do that or not. If they don't, they have C1 protection. If they do, it's C2 protection. But if they do seek protection, they have to prove that they did what the state asked them to do. That's still state action. It's the agency authority. But normal commissions, agents, you know, the FCC, SEC, IRS, all of them, they all have procedural guidelines, qualifications, and safeguards, right? There's all sorts of stuff for them to make sure that they don't infringe upon our rights. Private entities aren't subject to that. And because of that, they're doing whatever they want.
I was going to say, we had a case of that here, and I think I talked to you about this yesterday, which was Backpage.com. And Backpage.com was in 96 different countries, 80% of the child sex trafficking market. They were selling children online on Backpage. You could order up a child the way you ordered up a pizza. In April 6th of 2018, the Department of Justice came in and shut them down because of this law that we're talking about, because they transcended and violated their what they were supposed to be doing, and they lost their protection. They were instructing those that were advertising how to avoid detection by law enforcement, and as a result, Backpage.com, if you go to that site right now, it still says controlled by the Department of Justice. So this law is so important to protecting so many people, besides the fact that we want people to be able to have full self-expression, to be able to communicate, but the law in its vagueness creates issues and problems, and they for years made millions and millions of dollars on the sale of children because they were using this law for protection against stopping their bad practice of selling children online.
Exactly. Backpage exploited its protection under the protection of government, and they went out and they did unlawful things. Things that are not that of a good Samaritan.
Correct.
And had the courts implemented Section 230 correctly. Now keep in mind, it means that the courts are culpable. Congress is culpable for all of this because it was Congress that wrote Section 230, and it is the courts, the government, who is protecting them. The point is that we're not infringing upon the First Amendment rights of these companies. We're not protecting the First Amendment rights of these companies. They can do whatever they want. But the liability shield is the government's fault, and that needs to go away. If the company is doing something unlawful, why is the government protecting them? It makes no sense. And it is because a law that was intended to protect these companies from removing bad stuff has literally authorized them to do bad stuff.
Correct.
It's worked backwards. And that's what we're trying to fix. And the thing that is amazing that I'm running into, and we talked about this yesterday, is I have a lot of experience in this. I was hired specifically because I have so much experience in this. I wrote the Online Freedom Act. I mean, I co-authored it with David Morgan, who we mutually know, surprisingly.
Yes.
And I did the job correctly for We the People. It protects the people, and I did it correctly. And I've gone to Congress, and I've met with some Congress members, and the opposition I get is, well, I have legislation. But it's wrong, sir. But I have it. But it's wrong. Like, it's wrong. And I can show you why it's wrong. And not only that, I can defend every single thing in the OFA because I have done this for 6 solid years. So the question we have, for your audience, is shouldn't our Congress, who messed this up, shouldn't they be trying to fix it? And if they don't understand it, which I've clearly seen as I've come through, why are they trying to fix it without going to an expert on it? It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. So
is this one of those cases where... Is this one of those cases where we're going to have to hold Congress, the Congress, accountable for the unintended consequence, yet again, of one of their laws that they're not properly interpreting or not enforcing? So it seems to me that you put a face on it. That, you know, you've got to say, here's the unintended consequence. Here's what's happening. Here's the danger. Because if you don't do that, we are in serious trouble here because of the abuses of not implementing CDA to Section 230 the way that it should be.
Correct. And in fact, I would even add this, and I can kind of simplify this whole thing for everybody, because I consistently, you know, the right's argument is that there's too much censorship. The left's argument is there's not enough censorship and antitrust. And I unfortunately, here is the answer to it all. There is no possible way constitutionally that censorship can be stopped by government. It cannot, because that's what's called compelling speech, which is an infringement upon the service provider's speech. And just the same, the government can't authorize a private entity to restrict the liberties of myself and everyone else, meaning they can't restrict our speech under the protection of the government either.
Jason,
the government needs to respect both.
I totally agree, and I so appreciate that. We have to end here. I will have you back. Jason Fike, founder of the Social Media Freedom Foundation. If you are an advocate for free speech and for not censorship, please, please support his efforts. I'm Kathleen Wynn with Wynn Tucson. Thank you so much for being with us today. And we will be back next week. And have a great weekend. And okay, Wildcats, don't let me down. Go Wildcats.